Hello, and welcome to the Late and Cassette Podcast, and today I'll be covering Beyond the Mat. Before I get into Beyond the Mat, I just wanted to let you know I have a YouTube channel now where I'm uploading classic episodes of the podcast and doing some unboxing videos. I have a couple up there now. I'll be doing some more probably this weekend, so I'll have some probably by next week. But be on the lookout for the Late and Cassette YouTube channel. But now back to Beyond the Mat. Beyond the Mat is a documentary about the professional wrestling business as it was in the late 90s. It was made by Barry Blaustein. Blaustein was a Saturday Night Live writer and also wrote a lot of Eddie Murphy's early comedies, including Welcome to America. Blaustein described himself as a closet wrestling fan, and he got the backing of Ron Howard to make the documentary. Blaustein first approached the WWF through Ted DiBiase, but Vince McMahon, WWF owner, declined. He then approached WCW, who were not interested. Blaustein approached Vince again, and this time, Vince accepted. Terry Funk was the first big-name wrestler to sign on, and he urged Blaustein to come check out the promotion ECW. Blaustein agreed and said that Paul Heyman is one of his favorite people he has ever met in wrestling. During the course of filming, wrestling exploded, thanks to WCW's NWO storyline and the WWF's Attitude Era anchored by Stone Cold Steve Austin vs. Vince McMahon. Blaustein has also said that the WWF, as they got more popular, he felt Vince regretted letting him do the documentary. Blaustein has also said he wanted to film the Royal Rumble in the 1999 main event as its climax. The Royal Rumble main event, which was the championship match, which was Mankind versus The Rock in an I Quit match, though I guess technically the Royal Rumble match itself was the main event. Initially, though, he was turned down by several of Vince's top executives. After he got on the phone with Vince, Vince agreed to let him film, but it would be his last day and his last chance to film anything. Blaustein met Mick Foley while Mick Foley was in between promotions. Foley signed on to be in the movie, but he had to drop out after he signed with the WWF. However, after Vince gave his blessing for Blaustein to do the movie, Mick signed back on. After the movie was done, Vince tried to shut it down. The movie earned the tagline, "The movie Vince McMahon doesn't want you to see." He decided not to promote it in order Foley not to promote it either. However, Foley decided to promote the film anyway, including doing a sit-down with Blaustein on Larry King. Blaustein has said he thinks this is one of the reasons there became a major rift between Mick and Vince. It very well could be, because Mick Foley, through the years, if you followed his career, he doesn't always do the what would be the company thing to do, you would say. Bruce Prichard, who was one of Vince's top confidants from about 87 to 2008, who is now currently back with the WWE, has said this is because it wasn't supposed to be released in theaters, the reason Vince tried to shut it down. And another reason Vince tried to shut it down is because other promotions were included, ECW. Even though that really doesn't carry a whole lot of weight, in my opinion, because the WWF had a working relationship with ECW back in early 1997, and even had Paul Heyman on the WWF payroll because the WWF took so many of his top stars. So basically, the reason Vince tried to shut it down is Vince couldn't control the narrative, and he wasn't getting any money. Prichard also said that the WWF wanted to use this film as a type of propaganda for new recruits. Prichard covered this on his podcast, Something to Wrestle. They did a watch-along, and he gave little tidbits as him and his co-host watched the movie. Beyond the Mat premiered on October 22nd, 1999, and was released in theaters in March of 2000. It made about $2 million half a million dollar budget, so roughly $500,000. We start with a narration from Blaustein about his love of wrestling as a kid. He talks about going to an event with his dad when he was a kid and seeing one of the wrestlers leaving with his family, and he had a epiphany that these wrestlers were real people. This was accompanied by a dramatization, and the wrestler in question to me looked to be Bruno Sammartino, but he never named him by name, so it could be anyone, I guess. Fast forward 30 years and he's a screenwriter with a wife and kids, but he still loves wrestling. We see some WWF highlights from about 96 to 1998-ish, and he ponders what type of humans do this for a living and what drives them. We cut to WWF headquarters as it was back in the late 90s. Barry tells us about Vince, and we cut to an interview with him, and he tells Blaustein that we make movies. It's a terrible Vince impression. With a smug-ass look on his face, and he takes a big gulp of water. And we cut to Vince showing Mick Foley in his Cactus Jack, or not Cactus Jack, his Dude Love persona, how to dance. For those who are unaware, Mick Foley had three different personas that he wrestled under: Cactus Jack, Dude Love, and Mankind. We see former writer Vince Russo giving Sable instructions, and we briefly stop in and see Jim Johnston, who was in charge of writing entrance themes and other music for the WWF. We peek in a meeting, and we learn here that WWF and South Park were the two top-selling licensed merchandise getters in that particular quarter of that year. So I would think it would definitely be 98. They stop in, they talk to Jim Bell, who was head of merchandise, and I believe he ended up going to jail for some kind of fraud, some kind of bullshit with the company. So that's good. Blaustein sits in on a meeting between Vince and Darren Drozdoff, who was a former Denver Bronco. His claim to fame was he famously puked during a Monday Night Football game. And this particular meeting was specifically staged for the documentary, because I think Blaustein's idea was he wanted an upcoming star, or a current star, and someone who was nearing retirement. In the meeting, we see Vince, his son Shane, and head of talent relations Jim Ross, along with Draws, of course. Vince jokes about naming Draws Puke, and Vince pushes Draws to puke on his opponents or referees after the match, which is not entertaining. It's fucking disgusting. Vince gives Draws a garbage can, and in his over-the-top Mr. McMahon voice tries to get him to puke. Draws can't do it, and they all share a good laugh about it. Cut to Just Incredible, who tells us his biggest mistake was staying with the WWF for as long as he did. Al Snow talks about a meeting with Vince where Vince promised to help him achieve his goals, and Snow says, in his opinion, Vince didn't keep his promise. Which was kind of a bold thing to say, considering he was still employed with the company, and he still would be employed by the company for years after this. We get a VP of Creative Services telling the camera Vince keeps it fun for everyone and what a great guy he is. Afa, who was one of the Wild Samoans, and Coco Beware tell a couple of unflattering stories about Vince. Vince retorts by telling a story about Coco fighting one of his top executives in Europe, and he ended up firing both their asses. We see a young Dave Meltzer, who for better or worse is the premier wrestling journalist in the industry. It's a name that most casual fans probably wouldn't know, but everyone who follows behind the scenes stuff in wrestling knows who this fucking guy is. He tells us Vince is the greatest promoter ever and is also very untrustworthy. Yeah, no shit. Draws calls his mom and tells her she's going to be proud of him and tells her about his puke gimmick. Oh boy, I'm sure she would have been. We cut to a wrestling school and promotion, All Pro Wrestling. We meet the accountant who runs it, Roland Alexander. Roland is a carny asshole, and it looks like there's duct tape on his wrestling mat. It's very, very safe. We see him talking to a couple of hopefuls to enlist in his camp and asks for a $500 deposit right away. We also see him talking out by the ring, and he makes sure to tell all the trainees if they owe any money to pay up, because he will be out of town the next couple of days. We meet one of his most promising young students, Tony Jones. Tony has been working his day job at Visa and wrestling on the side, and he says he averages a whopping $25 a night. Sometimes he doesn't even get paid at all. He also says they don't get paid if Roland feels they don't deserve it. So Roland's talking head pops back up and says they all get paid, and he pays well. I think he says he's the best independent payoff guy in the business, which, doubt it. Mike Modest, another one of Roland's great students, is profiled next, and he lives above the gym and he works for a funeral home. We watch some of their indie show, and a wrestler goes up after a fan after he spits on him. The fracas gets breaking up. The wrestler in question who tried to attack the fan was actually Blaustein said he was a United Airlines pilot or mechanic, one of the two. He worked in the airline industry. Barry shows JR, Jim Ross, Talent Relations, the tape of Mike and Tony at the show. And JR seems to like what he sees and agrees to give them a tryout. We see legendary manager and wrestling personality Jim Cornette give them some advice before their match. Roland seems to think this would help APW big time. I'm not sure why. We'll go back to Pritchard a second. Pritchard said in his podcast that they were going to give these guys tryouts because they were in that area of the country anyway. But they staged it for the documentary, the whole JR watching the tape bullshit. We do see Pritchard throughout the documentary giving wrestlers direction from the gorilla position, which is the last stop before they walk out in front of the live audience. We see Roland watching the match along with JR, Cornette, and Vince. After the match, JR talks with the guys, and then they all take off. Roland said afterward that Barry didn't make him look very good, and Roland says that he looked fat in the documentary. Roland, you look fat because you are fat, and wearing a tight-ass white t-shirt that doesn't help matters at all, you fucking carny bitch. We then check out Terry Funk, who is Blaustein's favorite wrestler growing up. We see Terry's wife waking him up in the morning. We see this whole little scene interspliced with footage from some of Terry Funk's more hardcore matches. This part here takes place around 1997. Terry's daughters tell Barry that his cameras, they wish their dad would retire. And this whole little scene here is taking place at one of their weddings. We cut to a doctor telling Terry how screwed his knees are. Terry ignores his doctor because he is helping a newer promotion, ECW, get off the ground. His wife tells the cameras she wanted him to stop around 1990, so keep in mind, this is 7 years after she wishes he would have retired. We see some rabid ECW fans waiting for the show to start. Barry shows us where ECW produces their show. They produce it out of Paul Heyman's parents' house, I believe it is. Heyman tells us a little bit about his promotion, and what Barry is featuring here is ECW's first pay-per-view, which could be a whole podcast in and of itself. Heyman gives his troops a great pep talk before the show, and he thanks Terry Funk by name. Terry warms up as we see some action from the show. Terry's family watches from a press box in the arena, I guess it was, though I don't think... The ECW arena was famously a bingo hall, so I don't know if there were press boxes in the old bingo hall. We then see clips from the match that Terry was in, which Terry ends up winning, and thusly, he became the ECW World Heavyweight Champion. We see Terry getting worked on after the match with dried blood everywhere, and he has a terrible cough. If you've ever seen a wrestler with Mickey Rourke, where you would see Mickey's matches and he looks all fucked up and death pretty much after the match, this would be I guess you could say a real life version of it, but being that you never know what's real or fake in wrestling, was Terry faking it up for the camera? You never know, but this looks like it could have been straight out of that movie, The Wrestler. We see a Mick Foley promo for an upcoming match against Funk. Funk was one of Mick's mentors when he was coming up in the business. Barry gives us Mick Foley's backstory, and we meet Mick's two young children, Noel and Dewey. Mick's father tells us how nice and polite his son is, which you never think from watching him wrestle. We cut back to seeing Mick Foley getting fucked up from some of his most dangerous bumps, falls in the wrestling speak. JR said something chilling that anyone who followed Mick's career can understand. He said, "I don't know if Mick enjoys the pain, but I don't think he hates it." And that could probably sum up Mick Foley's career. We see Mick spending time with his wife and kids, and he seems like a very doting dad. Barry plays a message from Mick that he says is incoherent and rambling, but it doesn't seem like it to me. But then again, I don't know Mick Foley, so I don't know. They play the vicious falls he took during his legendary Hell in a Cell match against The Undertaker, and Mick says his wife called him after the match. His wife was very upset, and I think she said the kids were too, and she asked him for no more matches like that, and that started Mick, you could say it kind of started him dialing it back a little bit, but he always... If Mick Foley ever strayed from the hardcore violence, it wasn't for very long. He always found a way to get back there. Barry says while visiting Mick, he got a call from the wrestler he was most anxious to meet, Jake the Snake Roberts. Barry heads out to meet the former superstar. We get a clip from Jake's WrestleMania 6 promo against Ted DiBiase, which is considered a masterful promo. YouTube Jake the Snake WrestleMania 6 if you don't know what I'm talking about or if you haven't seen it in a long time. It's one of the better wrestling promos you'll see. They play some classic clips of Jake while Blaustein gives us some backstory along with Heyman, JR, and Vince talking about how great and destructive Jake the Snake is. And indie promoter shows up in the dock and says 2 days before Jake was to wrestle on his show, Jake called and said if he couldn't find him any crack, he wouldn't show up. So, tries to give you a little illustration of what Jake was like or going through at the time. Jake says into the camera that sometimes the person he hates the most in his life is looking back at him in the mirror. One thing Vince also said is that he never knew if he was talking to the man behind Jake the Snake or the Jake the Snake character. Which is a pretty interesting take because Blaustein would accuse Vince of becoming his Mr. McMahon character behind the scenes in his last dealings with him at the end of making his documentary. Barry sets out to meet Jake in North Platte, Nebraska, where Jake is set to wrestle on an independent show. Backstage at the show, we see the former WWF superstar Greg the Hammer Valentine also getting ready. Jake pisses in a garbage can, so that's normal behavior. Coco Beware is also at the event. Jake gives us some insight into his ring psychology after the match, and he brings up a young female fan in the ring and wraps one of his pythons around her and lets her soak up some love from the crowd. Jake later tells Barry that she will probably have 7 kids to 7 different men and be a cross-dressing lady truck driver, but at least she will always have the memory of that night. Well, what the fuck, Jake? I wish Jake had done uppers instead of downers because he is a major buzzkill. Jake the Snake in this movie is a fucking loon. Jake talks about how much he's loved by the fans and blah blah. The next day, Blaustein and Jake make an 8-hour drive. Blaustein doesn't tell us where they're going, though. I guess to another independent show. Jake tells Blaustein a story that is pretty familiar to wrestling fans, especially Jake Roberts fans. In fact, there's a documentary series called Dark Side of the Ring that just covered this fairly recently. Jake's father is Grizzly Smith. Grizzly Smith was a wrestler. Well, Grizzly raped the 13-year-old daughter of the woman he was dating at the time. The rape resulted in the young teen becoming pregnant. The child she was pregnant with grew up to become Jake the Snake Roberts. Blaustein and Jake go to Grizzly's place. Blaustein said they spent an hour together and they barely looked at each other the entire time. Jake tells a story that his father never loved him, and after Jake's first match, Grizzly walked up to him and told him he was ashamed of Jake and he would never amount to anything. Jake said he figured he would have to become a bigger and better star than Grizzly to gain his father's love, and he did just that. Became a bigger and better star than Grizzly ever was, but it still didn't earn him his father's love. Then the walking, talking piece of shit, Grizzly Smith, tells Blaustein, this is just rich, Jake was born out of love, and I still love him. What a fucking sick, pathetic, worthless excuse for a human that fucking guy was. Jake also tells a story of a sister who was late teens, early 20s, where she ended up, when she was in her late teens and early 20s, she ended up marrying a 40 to 50 year old man, only for her to be kidnapped and murdered by the man's ex-wife. They never found the body. The woman went to prison for 10 years for kidnapping, but still refused to tell them where the body was, even after she got out. This was also profiled in Dark Side of the Ring recently. There's lots of conspiracy theories about the missing daughter of Grizzly. Jake then goes on to talk about having his pick of the litter as far as ring rats goes. That's groupies for wrestling. And how after doing a lot of crazy shit at home, he couldn't get stimulated at home. Meaning he couldn't fuck. We go to a clip from the Royal Rumble and we spend a little time with China. China talks about how her mother thought she was a lesbian because she lifted weights so hard. China's personality behind the camera seemed bubbly and definitely not what she portrayed on camera. We also meet Matt Heisson, aka Spike Dudley. He is a former third grade teacher and talks about his love of wrestling and quotes Shakespeare. We see Jesse Ventura winning the Minnesota governorship and he talks about how he is really a softie behind the camera. Blaustein also talks about the beginning of Vince's transformation into Mr. McMahon in front of the camera. Barry also talks to New Jack, who sadly has just recently died. New Jack tells Blaustein that he used to be a bounty hunter and he has 4 justifiable homicides. Later on, New Jack leaves Barry a message that he is coming to visit LA. Barry got him an audition from some casting agents, I guess, and we see a clip of it. One of the producers thinks he could be Denzel's friend, but not the leading man. New Jack would go on to become neither one of those things. We go back to see Terry Funk announcing at a banquet that 1997 would be his last year wrestling. He gets a standing ovation from everyone in attendance, and I believe this is the Cauliflower Alley Club, which honors some of wrestling's greatest legends every year. Terry plugs his retirement match, and Barry talks to a couple of European fans who came over to see the event. Then it happens. We meet Dennis motherfucking Stamp, a former wrestler who never quite made it in the business, but he became something of a cult figure after this movie. I originally thought cult hero, but I don't know if hero's the right word. Dennis, in the current time this documentary was made, was an exterminator. Barry asks Dennis if he's coming to the show, and Dennis says, no, I'm not booked. Dennis goes on a little bit of a tirade because he thinks he would have been fucking awesome Side note, Barry asked Terry if he knew anyone who hadn't quite made it in the business, and Terry referred him to Dennis. And Dennis threw a big fit one day when Barry told him he couldn't make it to film because he was late and he was filming Terry. And Dennis blamed Terry Funk. Even he went on a big tirade about Terry, fuck Terry Funk, he gets everything, I get nothing, blah, blah, blah. Dennis wouldn't have even been in the fucking movie if it wasn't for Terry Funk. Then we see Dennis's workout routine. Jumping up and down on a trampoline with dumbbells while wearing a banana hammock. What the fuck? He delivers a great line here. Kind of sad and pathetic, but he goes, I'm only 50 now, and the phone can ring at any time. Dennis, your last match from your own mouth was in 1991. It was 1997 when this was filmed. The phone isn't ringing, bro. Dennis and Terry meet up, and Terry asks Dennis if he's going to come, but Dennis refuses because he isn't booked. Terry begs him, and Dennis argues with him. Terry offers Dennis to referee him and Bret Hart in the main event. Dennis appreciates it, but refuses. We get some B-roll footage here of the arena getting ready for the event and the ring being set up. Dennis shows up, and he agrees to referee the show because it's the main event. We see them getting ready, and we see some clips from the show. Terry makes his entrance, and Tommy Dreamer presents him with the ECW World Heavyweight Championship belt. And Paul Heyman announces him as the lifetime ECW champion. We see some clips of Bret and Terry's match, and Terry gives a speech to the crowd after Terry loses. That's usually the way it goes in wrestling. You do the honors, the job, whatever they call it. You definitely lose on the way out, typically. Barry catches up with Jake the Snake in Nebraska. Jake tells Barry he is going to go visit his daughter, and they set off to go see her. Jake tells Barry he loves his children, but he doesn't really know how to be a dad. We meet Jake's daughter, Brandy. She keeps a scrapbook of all the letters he sent her, even though she ripped some of them up. She really feels screwed because he wasn't there for her when she was a kid. He calls her when he makes it to his hotel, and she agrees to come, but she plans on bringing a couple of friends. He goes and meets her at the restaurant in the hotel, and it was the first time he had seen her in 4 years. And according to Blaustein, Jake leaves about 5 minutes after meeting her. He goes to her place at some point and meets her, and he basically alludes to suicide, and that gets her upset, obviously. They seem like they have a heart-to-heart, and Jake basically just tells her he's lost, and that's kind of what he is. They leave, Jake checks into a hotel, and Barry said when they met up later, Jake had been smoking crack. Jake runs through all the drugs he's done in his life, and it's basically just this is a rambling, incoherent mess. For sure. We meet back up with Mick Foley, walking through a hotel. Mick has brought his kids to the Royal Rumble, where he is defending the WWF Championship. We see him and The Rock, his opponent for the evening, going over some spots for the match. Barry talks to some fans outside of the arena who love Mick, and basically the reason they love Mick is because he can take any kind of punishment and still bounce back. Which, when you do that, you set a dangerous precedent for yourself. Because you always have to top yourself. Backstage, Mick assures his kids he will be okay, and The Rock comes over and talks to the children. Stone Cold pops by to say hello, which is kind of funny, because Blaustein said Steve Austin was one of the most standoffish people backstage while he was filming, and Steve Austin would always be giving him dirty looks, so it's kind of funny he just decides to pop in and make a little cameo. Vince gives directions to the announcers as the way the match is supposed to go, and we see a young as fuck Stephanie McMahon sitting by him. We see all the final show prep as Mick's wife and children take their ringside seats, and The Rock cuts a promo before the match. We cut to The Rock and Mankind making their entrances. We see highlights of the brutal match and I Quit match. Stand By Me plays while we see shots of the match and Mick spending time with his family. Then we see The Rock handcuff Mick's hands behind his back. The Rock then proceeds to hit Mick in the head 11 times with a chair as the kids scream and cry in horror. The Rock won after a recording of Mick saying I Quit plays over the PA system. Mick gets a standing ovation backstage and tries to reassure his kids and wife that he is okay. We see Mick getting stitched up backstage and little chats with the doctors and his wife, checking, you know, asking questions to make sure he isn't concussed, which he had to be. I don't see how he couldn't be. But after this, Mick goes and talks to The Rock after the match, and everything seems cool. But in real life, Mick Foley held some resentment for years after the match because the number of chair shots and how hard they were. Mick goes to talk to Vince after the match, and Vince seems happy with it. He cringed a little when Mick asked about the amount of blood, and Vince said, I'll let you know how it was when I get the feedback or something, and Mick gives you, well, for every 5 people offended, there's 100 that loved it type thing. Weeks later, Barry shows Mick the footage of his family at ringside, and Mick seems genuinely upset about what he put them through and seems to want to turn away from such a hardcore style. This is pretty much the end of the doc. We get Barry telling us that Tony Jones and Michael Modis never heard from the WWF. Tony did have some matches in the WWF / WWE in the years since the documentary was released. And Mike did wrestle in some other promotions throughout the years, including TNA, which was the number 2 promotion from about 2002 to about, I don't know, 2016, 17-ish. TNA / Impact Wrestling really fell off the map. It's not important, but they did have some moderate success, I guess you could say. Terry Funk came out of retirement 3 months later and sporadically wrestled until the latest match I could find looked like 2017, 20 years after his retirement match. His wife Vicky has died fairly recently, though 27 or 2018 she did pass, and I don't think Terry has done a whole lot since then. Jake went to jail for paid child support, and he continued to struggle with drugs and alcohol until fellow wrestler DDP moved him in and helped him get sober in 2012. So the Jake Roberts story does have a happy ending. Draws became a regular until 1999 when he became paralyzed from the neck down after an in-ring accident in a match against D'Lo Brown. D'Lo went to powerbomb him and kind of dropped him on his neck. Draws didn't have any feeling. I think he has some use of his hands now, but he is still in a wheelchair. The positives, it seems like the most honest, genuine documentary made about wrestling, probably because Barry was unbiased. It was very interesting to see all the behind-the-scenes stuff and Vince directing talent. The negatives, it's hard to point out a lot of them, but it was filmed between 1997 and 1999. Most wrestling fans would know the timeline, but non-fans who might get curious and watch the doc might get a little confused by it. It's like Terry Funk retired in 1997. Now, there is no mention of this in the documentary, but he came out of retirement in 1997, I guess, the same year. But when he came to the WWF, he came again in early 98, and he was a tag team with Mick Foley for a while, well, when Mick was in his Mankind persona, and they even won the tag titles. It's not mentioned, but when people, if they go to look up, you know, like my wife's a big person, when we're, if we're watching a documentary, she'll get on Google or see what happened to the people before it's even over. So if people get on and see, like, Google Terry Funk and see all, you know, all the shit he did, it might confuse the timeline. But if you're just watching it in a vacuum, it would be fine. Overall, it was a good documentary, probably the best on wrestling. It is informative, and it gives us a very raw look at his subjects. Thumbs up for me. Well, I've been feeling some nostalgia lately for my early teens, and I'm going to look at a movie from those years, which is also at the tail end of the VHS days, and it features a man we saw in this movie, The Rundown, featuring The Rock, well, starring The Rock and featuring Sean William Scott, is up next. So look for that one here on the Latent Cassette Podcast. And don't forget to check out my YouTube channel, where one of the videos I do cover this Mick Foley Rock feud. There'll be some other stuff. I'm going to do games as well on the YouTube channel. There'll be some things you wouldn't normally get on the podcast. So please look for me on YouTube, Twitter, and on Facebook. The Latent Cassette Podcast.